Yes.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sheldon Fetty. I'm an alcoholic. And there is great energy in this room. You guys must love Alcoholics Anonymous or something, right? Holy cow. Man, I love getting to come to conferences and hanging out with people that are in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. It just makes you feel alive. I'm really blessed because I get to go to a couple of these a year. Right? Some people get together once a year or twice a year. You get to have a conference and feel this energy. And I'm so grateful that I get to come and share that with you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about me, because that's what we got for the next hour or so, is me. It's my favorite topic. Hopefully it won't bore you too much, but I know I'm going to have a blast anyway. I was born in England in a small town called Leeds, about 200 miles straight north of London. I don't sound like it, because I moved to America when I was 16 years old, and I've always thought of myself as kind of a chameleon, right? Anywhere I go, I can kind of fit in. My brother says it's because I have no real personality of my own. I don't know. I think he might be right. He might be right. But I've lost my accent, but I was born in England. I was not born to alcoholic parents. And I don't know if that somehow makes me less of an alcoholic. All right, seems like everybody wants to brag about their alcoholic mom and dad, and this thing's hereditary, and I don't know, it might be, but I fail on that count. My mom, I took her out on Mother's Day for breakfast. We do this every year. We go out, and every year, I order her a glass of wine. She doesn't order a glass of wine. I order her a glass of wine. She slowly and painfully sips this glass of wine, which I tell you ruins my entire breakfast, right? Finally, I get the opportunity to order her a second glass of wine. She has maybe one or two sips of that second glass of wine, and she says, "No, no, no, I'm starting to feel it." And, you know, I want to just shake her and say, "You have to drink through that, Mom. Drink through. Push. You're strong. You can make it." My dad told me one time that he had gotten drunk twice in his life. And he didn't like it because it spoiled his ability to enjoy what was going on. I was raised by animals, is what I'm trying to explain to you. I was raised by the wrong kind of people, clearly. They're not alcoholic. But my dad did leave. I was 2 years old when my parents got divorced. And I come from a small Jewish community in the north of England. And in the 1970s, when they got divorced, it was very unpopular. Like today, it's you know, it's not a big deal. We've all had at least one, right? I know I have, right? But back then, it was super, super uncommon in this small Jewish community. And my dad left, and when he left, our lives changed radically. We were in a middle-class, nice Jewish neighborhood, and we moved into a non-Jewish, anti-Semitic Section 8 housing. We were welfare, family, food stamps, the whole nine yards. This is where you go, "Aww, thank you." I knew I liked people from Georgia. I knew we were going to get along just fine. Right. So my dad leaves and our life changes, and I hate my life. I hate where I live and I hate who I'm around. I hate my dad. My dad left. He was my number one hate. I hated him. He split room. My life did not like my dad. Hated my dad. Didn't like my mom. My mom screamed and yelled a lot. Hated my mom. Hated my brother. Did not like my brother at all. Hated my brother. And my grandparents hated my grandparents. Did not like them at all. Hated my neighbors and my teachers. Now, I didn't know you. But if I did, I can guarantee I would have hated you too. I was just an angry kid. I was uptight and I was frustrated. And I didn't even really know there was anything wrong because it was my only experience. But I just felt like, I don't know, life was more difficult than it had to be. Life was hard, and I didn't like it. I didn't like anything about it. And I was 9 years old. And I had this friend, Barry. Barry was cool, right? Because Barry was 11. And when you're 9, 11 is cool. And I would have done anything Barry wanted to do. In hindsight, I'm grateful all he wanted to do was drink, right? Or who knows what direction my life would have gone. But Barry wanted to drink. He was 11, I was 9, and we went and stood in front of a liquor store until some guy was willing to get us a bottle of something. Some guy ultimately was. He got us a bottle of Old English apple cider. It's apple juice with a kick. We went into this wooded area, and Barry opens up this bottle of Old English apple cider. At that moment in my life, I don't like me either, right? I am short. I have always been short, right? And my son, who was 18, when he was like growing up, we would measure back to back, right? See who's tallest, right? And he was like 14 years old. And he was taller than me. And after he got kids, I was so excited, right? Yeah, the little guy's finally taller than me. And he says, no big deal, Dad. You're short. All right? But I'm short, and I've always struggled with my weight. I'm short, and I'm fat, and I'm this Jewish kid in this non-Jewish neighborhood with a lot of anti-Semitism. And my parents are divorced, and we're poor, and I just hate my life, right? And I get this bottle of Old English apple cider, and I take a big swing on this thing. And what happened next was going to happen almost every time I drank from that day until the day I quit drinking. I puked out of my nose. Because I'm a nose puker. I got an admission to make. I am not very good at drinking. Some of you are really good at it, right? You carry a little bottle of warm vodka in your pocket or your purse, and when you drink, right, you shoot pool better when you're drinking than when you're sober, and if you're a musician, you play guitar or whatever better when you're drunk than when you're sober. You talk to the opposite sex better when you're drunk than when you're sober. God help us all, some of you drive better when you're drunk than when you're sober, right? The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we are often dangerously or disgustingly antisocial. I am not very dangerous. But I'm disgusting. I'm the break something, spill something, say something inappropriate, embarrass myself alcoholic. What I really am is I am a pee on the couch, hit on your mom kind of drunk. I came to after a party. And my friend and his wife are staring at me because I fall asleep on their couch. And when I started to wake up, she left the room in disgust. And I said to him, what happened? And he said, don't you remember? And I said, well, no, it wasn't uncommon. I often didn't remember. And he said, last night at the party, you hit on her mom and you peed on our couch. These are not metaphors. These are actual experiences. But I finally get over this nose puking, and I'm able to hold some of this booze down. And I tell you, I had an amazing experience. Because I was 9 years old, and I'm short, and I'm fat, and I'm the awkward Jew in the room, and my parents are divorced, and we're a poor family, and everything is wrong in my life, and nothing really happened. But I tell you, emotionally, for me, mentally, inside of me, it felt like everything changed. It felt like I grew a couple of inches. It felt like I lost 20 pounds. It felt like my parents got back together. It felt like we had money in the bank. It felt like my foreskin grew back. I want you to know that I am properly ashamed of that joke. I am. I just want to make sure you're listening. Because later in the talk, much later, there's some good stuff. Not yet, but it's coming, and I just want to make sure you're listening. So what happens to me is I get this drink inside of me, and everything changes. For the first time in my life, it seems like life makes sense. For the first time in my life, it feels like I can breathe. For the first time in my life, it feels like I have found the answers to the questions. It just feels like this is how I'm supposed to be. And I make a decision that I'm going to drink as much as I can, whenever I can, as often as I can, from that day until the day that I die. And I make that decision at 9 years old. Now, I don't start drinking every day at 9 years old. My mom's pretty strict. My life doesn't work that way. I'm a typical 9-year-old kid. I probably get drunk 2 or 3 more times that year, 3 or 4 times the following year. But by the time I am 13, 14 years old, I am drinking something, taking something, smoking something, doing something, right, every single day of my life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't want to upset any of the old-timers. I'm a drunk. It's the only disease I have is alcoholism. But I tell you, I'm a pig. I will do anything that changes the way that I feel. And one of the funny things that we say to newcomers is you need to have a program of rigorous honesty. Tell the truth in everything you do, except in the meeting, lie and pretend you didn't do drugs. So I don't want to offend you if you're over 80 and you never got to smoke any dope, but but anyway, so I become a pig and I love it. I love drinking. I love everything about it. I love the way it makes me feel, and I love the freedom that it gives me. I feel like I have found this magic elixir. And I remember things in pictures. I remember this one particular time. I'd moved to California at this point, and I live in Southern California, but I've gone up to Shoreline Amphitheater in Mountain View, California, to see this little band, the Grateful Dead. And I'm at the very back of the auditorium. I'm on 4 hits of window pane, and Bobby Weir screams out, "It looks like rain." And the thunder's in the sky, there's lightning, and I have a spiritual experience, the likes of which no 12-step call has given me since. Magical and beautiful. I love drinking. I love everything about it. And I know I'm going to do it forever. And I know this because I tell people, if you ask me, look, I love drinking. And if I ever want to quit, I'll quit. I'll quit if I want to. Anybody here ever say, "I'll quit if I want to"? I just don't want to, right? I will. I'll quit if I want to. I'm 21 years old, and I get this really goofy little break. I get very lucky. I was a fairground pitchman. I sold Ginsu knives at state and county fairs. But wait, there's more. I get this goofy lucky break, and I end up on QVC, and I'm the national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances at 21 years old. And I'm like Bill Wilson. I have arrived. All of a sudden, what has happened to me is I've gone from this poor kid from the wrong side of the tracks. I got money, and I got applause, and I got recognition, and I got respect. I have everything in my life handed to me that I thought, if I had had those things, I wouldn't have drank the way that I drank. If you would have asked me 6 months before that opportunity came along, I would have told you, if I had an opportunity like that, then I would quit drinking because I would want to, because every problem in my life just got fixed. And what was crazy to me is that I started to drink more. What happened to me is that the cuffs were taken off. I was given the ability to do whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted. The money was thrown at me. People were taking care of me. And I just started to drink with abandon. And this will shock you. I lost that job. You know, when they fired me, I knew why. We always know why, don't we, when we get fired? We've always got a reason why, and I knew why. It was Bernard. He didn't like Jews. You know, I feel bad for the typical white American, because you don't know who to blame. If you're from a minority, we know who to blame, baby. It's you, and it's your fault. And I tell you, I lived on that one for a long time. It was Bernard's fault. He did not like me because of my religion. That's not what they said when they fired me. What they said when they fired me was they said they thought it was inappropriate for them to have an alcoholic crack addict as their national spokesperson. I thought that was a little bit of an overreaction, but, you know, that there you go. What do you know, you can't fight City Hall, I guess. I had a good resume, and I got another good job, and then I lost that job, and I lost the next job, and I lost the next job. And the next thing you know, I've burned it all out. I'm 25 years old, and I've already been a rocket ship, and now I got nothing, and I'm basically homeless. I'm living by the kindness of my friends. I'm sleeping on their couches. I can get a job. I can't keep a job, and I feel like my life is over, and it dawns on me, now would be a good time to want to quit drinking. And so I decide, you know what, that's it. I'm done. I'm going to quit drinking. That's it. I quit. I mean, why wouldn't I? You look at the mess I've made in my life. It makes perfect sense that I should quit drinking. I go into a 7-day spin-dry detox. In there, I'm going to learn everything I need to know about quitting most of the time. right? And then from there, I went to a halfway house because I had nowhere else to go. And I stayed in this halfway house. And I tell you, I was pretty excited because these people gave me a little bit of hope. They told me that if I was to go to their meetings or whatever and read their pamphlet or their book or whatever and maybe take the steps or the stairs or the elevator or whatever the hell they were talking about, I'd be able to have a good life. And I went into this halfway house. And this halfway house, the people were nice in this halfway house. They gave you food, and they didn't demand the rent right away, and they took really good care of us, and it was beautiful. And I was excited about being there until I was about 27 days sober. When I was 27 days sober, I didn't know who these people were that wanted to tell me what time I should be home. Right? I mean, I'm the national spokesperson for Kenwood Appliances, for God's sakes. Not for the last 4 years, but I'm still like, I'm still waving that flag, right? I'm still living on dreams, right? And they wanted me to do a chore, which I thought was unreasonable. They wanted me to make my bed, and they wanted me to clean the bathroom. And I mean, I don't even like doing that stuff now, let alone. So I left, and this is the second shocker in my life. I didn't stay sober. I know, right? I know. What happened next, quite honestly, is best described as the worst 2 or 3 years of my life. Because for the next 3 years, what I did was I got drunk to get sober, to get sober, to get drunk, to get drunk, to get sober. What happened to me was that I would get a week and then I would drink. I would get 2 days and I would drink. I'd get one day and I would drink. I would get a week again and I would drink. And I didn't know why I kept drinking. It made no sense to me. When you look at my life, you look at the opportunities I've had, the God-given abilities that I clearly have, that I could make something of myself if I would just stop drinking. It makes no sense. You would have to be an idiot to drink again. And I would drink again. And I had no idea why, and it made no sense to me. And I would come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and there were things that people would say that made no sense to me. One of the things that people would say to me when I would come here one more time after another runner is they would say, "Are you done yet? Am I done what exactly? Have you had enough?" No. That's the problem, you see, is that I've never had enough. And I don't understand the language that you use when you ask me those questions. No, I haven't had enough. No, I'm not done. I can't imagine being done. I can't imagine what it would be like for me not to drink ever again. Because when I don't drink, here's what happens to me. I get this empty, vacant, lonely angst inside of me. What happens is I feel alone. What happens is I feel afraid, and I can't tell you I'm afraid. I feel insecure, and I can't tell you I feel insecure. I feel judged by you, and I can't tell you I feel judged by you. And I don't like you, and I know you don't like me. And my head starts to yell at me. It starts to say things like, "You're a piece of garbage. You've always been a piece of garbage. You're always going to be a piece of garbage. Why are you trying not to drink anyway? You're going to drink again. You always drink again. Why would you want to go through that pain and suffering of waiting 2 weeks to drink? You may as well drink now, you worthless scum. Have a drink. Have a drink. Have a drink. Have a drink. You may as well have a drink." Bah, 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 bah. And then what do? I come to the meeting and you say, "How are you doing?" I go, "Fine." Because I was trained in the bars and with the drinkers and with the dope smokers. And you can't say to your buddy when you stroll into the bar, "Hey man, how you doing?" "Oh, I'm doing pretty good. A little insecure, feeling judged, a little nervous. A little on edge and uptight. I know you don't like me. You're just pretending, but you know, don't worry. I don't like you either. Pull me a double." I mean, you can't. Right? So I don't know how to share those feelings with you. And so I tell you I'm doing okay when I'm not doing okay. And I'm afraid of something. I'm terrified of something. That's what I'm terrified of. I'm terrified that I'm going to come to AA and it's going to work. And that scares me. And here's why it scares me. Because I have one place of reckoning. I have one piece of information. I know what it feels like to be a week sober. And I think what you're saying to me is, "Sheldon, you know what? If you'll come to Alcoholics Anonymous, and you'll do everything we have to offer. Come to the meetings, get involved, get a sponsor, get a home group, get some commitments, go through the process, work the steps, make the amends. If you'll do all of that, you'll be able to stay sober one day at a time forever, and you'll be able to feel like you feel right now forever, ever, ever, ever." Some guy gets up and says he's 23 years sober. I'm thinking, you poor bastard, the guy said. Jesus Christ, I can't. Why would you want to do that to yourself? I have no perception of what it's like to be an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have no idea what it's like to be in the middle with a solution, feeling connected, feeling on fire. And I come to AA and I say to you guys, I don't understand what's going on, man. What is wrong with me? And I explain to you that it's bizarre because I don't want to get drunk. I don't want to get drunk. Here's what I want to do. I want to take the edge off. I got an edge. And I just want to take the edge off. And I know how to take the edge off. Here's what I'm going to do. I got a plan. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to leave here. And this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to get drunk. Why would I? It would be stupid. Look at my life. Look at what it's done. I'm living in a freaking halfway house from being, you know, somebody at some point in my own mind anyway. And now I'm this broke dude. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm not going to get drunk. I'm just going to go and I'm just going to have one. Maybe two. Three at the most. No more than four. Right? I mean, I'm serious about this. No, I'm going to have one, maybe two. Three at the most, no more than four. I'm done. But here's what happens. I get drunk. And I didn't mean to. It wasn't my plan. Next thing you know, I'm broke and I'm in trouble and I don't know what happened and I don't know how it happened. And I come to A and I explain that to you guys and you go, well, that's easy, kid. You have a phenomenon of craving. Now, I'm a little too embarrassed and insecure to tell you I have no idea what that means, right? So I go, oh, okay. It turns out if you're new, a phenomenon is something nobody understands, so it's okay if you don't understand it, right? It's perfectly fine if you don't understand. But then you explain to me that what that means is that you will drink against your will. Now, I don't want to be disagreeable, but I'm thinking back over my drinking, and I tell you, stood here tonight, I will tell you, I have never drunk against my will. Ever once. That is not how the phenomenon of craving shows up in my life. Here's how the phenomenon of craving shows up in my life. Because here's what that sounds like to me. It sounds to me like what happens is I crack the bottle and I take a drink. And after I take a drink, the bottle grows arms and legs. Grabs me by the throat, throws me on the bar, pulls itself down my throat. The whole time I'm screaming, stop, stop! I'm an alcoholic for crying out loud! What are you trying to kill me? Here's what happens to me. This is how the phenomenon of craving actually realizes itself in my life. I go out for one, maybe two, three at the most, no more than four. And somewhere between two and four, I change my mind. And that is what the phenomenon of craving looks like in my life. And it is hard for me to identify that when I'm new because every drink I ever took was my idea. It was a stupid idea. But it was my idea. And I got this thing that forces me to drink, puts me in a place to drink when I don't want to drink, when I promised I wouldn't drink because I have an allergic reaction that presents itself with me changing my mind. So you guys explain this to me, and now I know the answer, right? The answer is, oh, well, if that's the case, don't drink, stupid. Oh, okay, I won't drink anymore. Thank you for the information. Like Nancy Reagan, right? Just say no. That's my new plan, right? I'm in. I'm just not going to drink. Which would be great, except for what happens to me when I don't drink. I get all those feelings I talked about a few minutes ago. I get that angst, that insecurity. My head starts going on at me, and I just feel like I can't stand it. And it's, you know, it's not just me. I mean, I get all this stuff, but it's you, too. You do that thing. You know that thing you do, that breathing, right? Constant in and out and in and out. And I just get to where I just, right? I just... And if I tell you, I come to you and I say to you, look, man, I don't want to drink. I've been sober now a long time. I've been sober 3 days. And I don't want to drink, but I feel, And sometimes we make a mistake in AA. I don't think they do this in Georgia, but sometimes in Vegas, we make a mistake with new people where we give our best 5-minute pitch, and it sounds like we say this. If you'll come to my home group just once, sit in a meeting just once in the right chair, talk to the right person, read the right chapter out of the book, the next day you'll be perfect and your life will be wonderful, and you'll never want to drink again. And if that's not what you're doing something wrong. When the reality is, if you're going to stay sober and you're new, be prepared to be uncomfortable for a little while. It is part of getting sober. Getting sober sucks. The good news is that you can get sober one time and you don't have to do it over and over and over and over again like I did, right? But you got to be prepared to be uncomfortable in early sobriety. It's part of the drill, and we need to tell our new people that. We need to hold them and hug them and love them and tell them it's okay to be uncomfortable. But here's what I got told, and I tell you, with best intention.
Shelton, don't worry about that. Don't worry. Here's what, I know you can't stay sober forever. Do you think you could stay sober just till the end of the day? Yes, I think I can stay sober till the end. Well, here's what in AA, we don't stay sober forever. We stay sober one day at a time. And you say that like it's good news. But here's what it sounds like to me. In AA, we stay sober
one day at a time. One long, miserable day at a time. Forever. Ever.
Oh, baby. And if you say to an old timer, well, I can't do that. Don't worry. If you can't do a day at a time, sometimes we do it 1 minute at a time. Tick, tick, tick. Three and a half years, I went in and out, in and out, in and out, in and out, and I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't get a foothold here, and I didn't know why, and I started to think there was something wrong with me other than alcoholism. I got really lucky. I'm just going to dust off my soapbox for a minute. I got really lucky. I got sober before they were throwing pills at us for when we feel newly sober. I would hate to get sober today because they confuse real depression with early alcoholics, not early recovery. Can you imagine when I got sober? Here's what my life looked like when I got sober. I had been the national spokesperson of Kenwood Appliances. I had been a successful young businessman at 22, 23, 24 years old. I was on top of my game. I had come out of the Section 8 housing. I'm making lots of money. I got applause. I got success. Things are wonderful. I burned my life to the ground. Now I am broke. My dad won't talk to me. My mom has that tone in her voice when I talk to her. I haven't had a girlfriend for a long time. I'm disgusting and I smell bad and I'm broke and I live in a halfway house. If I wasn't depressed, they should have given me medication. I suffered horribly from situational depression. Alcoholics Anonymous changed my situation. Surprisingly enough, the depression went away. I will put my soapbox away again now. Tuck it safe. We won't throw it away because I might get it out again, but we'll tuck it neatly under the podium. So I show up at Alcoholics Anonymous in July of 1996, and I am more dead than alive, and I go into this room, and I don't expect it to work. Why would I? I've been coming for a couple, 3 or 4 years. I've been going in and out for a couple, 3 or 4 years. Why would I expect that Alcoholics Anonymous would work for me this time? It's never worked in the past. And the Buddhists say that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. And I can't tell you what it felt like when I was ready. I can't explain what that is like. And I want to judge new people for not being at that place yet. And I want to try and persuade people that they're at that place. And the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous is clear when it says, if a guy or gal's not at that place, let him go get to that place. Let him go get to that place. You might spoil a future opportunity. I showed up at that place. I wish I could. The only thing I did right in the journey to that place is I didn't let people chase me away. If you're new and you're struggling and you're going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous and you've been doing it for a while, I'm going to tell you the one thing you need to do is keep doing it. I don't care if you drink next week, next month, next year. Keep doing it. Keep showing up. Keep coming here. Because if you're lucky, if you're blessed, if you have the moment of clarity that I had, you might get a footing here and you might get to have the most amazing life that you're ever going to have. But if you quit showing up, I'm telling you, it can't happen for you. So keep showing up. Keep showing up. So I show up at this place called the Kiss Club. It's the typical AA club, like every AA club anywhere in the world. It has old tables that are peeled, chairs that are wobbly. You can't smoke in there, but the walls are nicotine yellow. I don't understand how that worked, but it's just this clubhouse. And I'm at this clubhouse, and this guy shows up for a noon meeting. It was a noon meeting that he doesn't usually go to, but he happened to be there that day, and he started to share. And this is what I remember him saying. I remember him describing alcoholism as a disease for him that began where the bag and the bottle ended. I heard another guy say a few years ago, and I love this, he said that he didn't suffer from his drinking at all. You did, but he didn't. Right? I didn't suffer from my drinking. I suffered from my trying to be sober. I suffered from when I put the plug in the jug. That's when my alcoholism really starts to kick in for me. And he talked about loneliness. He talked about being amongst his family and people he knew that loved him. And he couldn't feel it. And he knew they loved him, but it made him feel uncomfortable and more alone and more afraid and more uptight. And the good opportunities made him feel worthless. And bad opportunities made him feel worse. And he just felt this angst and this uncomfortability. And then he said, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is designed to treat. And later he showed me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he showed me nowhere in there does it say don't drink. Nowhere in there does it say don't drink, because we don't help you not drink. We help you stay comfortable while not drinking. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. So he started me on a journey through these steps, and the journey kind of went like this. The first step was pretty easy for me. You know, it was pretty clear that my life was unmanageable. I'd taken this nosedive. It was pretty clear that I couldn't quit drinking. It was pretty clear that I was powerless over alcohol. We didn't spend a lot of time talking about that. We just looked at my experience, and he would ask me questions like, well, do you have a good job? No. Pretty unmanageable. Friendly with your family? No. Pretty unmanageable. Can you quit drinking when you don't want to? When you want to? No. Pretty powerless. You know, how much money? No. You know, just all these questions about my life that drew attention to the fact that it was a disaster. And so I get step one, but then we start to talk about step two, and step two is very difficult for me. And I told him, I can't do step two. Can't do step two. Can't do it. Can't do step two. And from the way I look at things, if I can't do step two, can't do step three. Why can't you do step two? Well, I don't believe in God. What do you mean you don't believe in God? I don't believe in God. Don't believe in God. Never believe in God. Don't believe in God. Let me tell you something. I grew up in a Jewish home, but that's not really true. I grew up in an atheist Jewish home. And what that means is we're Jews, but we know we're wrong. The only people on the planet more wrong than us are our crazy Christian neighbors. I just want to point out, some of you laughed at the Jew joke and you didn't laugh at the Christian joke. You have work to do. Call your sponsor. I grew up in a home where we did all of the ritual stuff. You know, We lit candles and we said prayers and we did all that stuff, but there was no real talk of God. I didn't feel God in my home. I had resentments against some of the Jewish community for turning their back on us when the divorce happened. I went to a Jewish school, and if you've ever been to a religious school, you know that you blame the teachers for being teachers and you blame it on the religion, and I hated all the Jews. That was top of my list. I'm a self-hating Jew is what I am. There's millions of us. We're all over the place. Right? But I don't believe in my God, and I can't believe in your God. There's no way. It just doesn't make sense to me. Imagine if you were trying to get sober in a Muslim country, and they said to you, God, as he may express himself in our group conscience, you'd know who they meant. And I know who you mean, and I can't do your God, and I can't do my God, and I can't do step two. And my sponsor kind of looks at me and goes, well, that's interesting. It has nothing to do with step two. What do you mean? He says, you don't have to believe in God to do step two. What are you talking about? Of course you do. It says, come to believe in the power greater than myself. Of course you got to believe it. You got to believe in God. You got to believe in God. It says it in the step. He says, well, you know, if you take the steps off the wall, you're going to have some off-the-wall sobriety. We better crack that book and see what that book says. And on page 47 of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says this. First of all, it asks you to lay aside all prejudice, all prejudgment, everything you think you know about God. And I like that because it doesn't say throw it away. Some people come into AA with great religious beliefs and notions and convictions that they know are true. And Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't ask you to turn your back on them. But it does ask you to lay them aside. Now, if I take my phone and I lay it aside, what that means is it's close enough for me to pick it up when I need it. Just put it to the side, pick it up again later if you need it. You might love it, and you might become the holiest roller in your particular faith there is. And God bless you if you do. We encourage that. We encourage that in Alcoholics Anonymous. But we want you to come with an open mind. So lay aside prejudice. And then it says this. We're supposed to ask a newcomer. Step two, the actual work of step two. We're supposed to ask a newcomer. Do I now believe? Which I didn't. No, the answer is no, I do not believe. I don't believe. No. Stop asking me. Are you listening? I don't believe. He says, okay. It's a comma, not a period. Can we read the rest of the sentence?
Okay.
Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe? Now, if I have to be willing to believe, the implication is I don't believe right now. Therefore, it is okay for me not to believe. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that maybe there might be possibly, it's unlikely, I get it, probably not, but maybe, could there be, on a weird set of fluky circumstances, perhaps, maybe, some kind of a power greater than you? Maybe. I mean, is it possible? What do you think? Maybe? Yes. Right? I mean, even an idiot like me can say, I don't believe in God, but it's possible, I suppose, maybe it might be true, maybe. I'll commit to that. The book then says, if a man says he does believe, which I did not at the time, or is even willing to believe in a power greater than himself, we emphatically ensure him he's on his way. What does that mean, emphatically? Yeah, baby, you're done. Step two, in the bag. So if you're here tonight and you haven't done step two, guess what? You just did. Now what? Say the prayer. Say the goddamn prayer. But if I turn my will and my life over to the care of something I don't really believe in, won't that make me a hypocrite? Yes. Will it be the first time? Say the prayer, write the list, share the list. Write the list, share the list. Write the list? I'm not writing no list. Are you kidding me? Listen, I didn't spend a lot of time on the streets. Some of you did. Right? And we know who you are, by the way. But I didn't spend a lot of time on the street. But I know one thing. You don't write nothing down. Right? Deny, deny, deny. But on videotape, well, I can see how he kind of looks like me, but I'm telling you, that was not me, right? Write the list, share the list. 6 and 7, don't worry about 6 and 7. Nobody understands 6 and 7. Don't overburden yourself with that nonsense. 8 and 9 sound very expensive. They do. My sponsor told me, don't worry about 8 and 9. He said, they don't want your money. Oh, thank God. They want their money back. Oh, joy. 10 and 11, let's face it, they're so complicated and so confusing that half the people in the room right now think they're doing step 10 when they're really doing step 11. Some people went, uh-huh. Some people went, huh? If the huhs get with the uh-huhs, they'll show it to you in the book and you'll go, wow! I never knew that. But I'll tell you what's funny about that is it's all about our crazy spiritual arrogance, because who really cares? Right? I used to subscribe to this idea, and this is bizarre that I did this. I was right on cue, 3 to 7 years sober, had my AA cape, I was super AA guy. And I knew exactly the right way to do the steps. My home group was the good dope. If you didn't go to my home group, you were going to die, right? If you didn't do the steps exactly the way I do the steps, you were going to die. You had to have the commas in the right place, the right number of columns. Everything had to be perfect. Otherwise, I'm sorry. I don't care how long you're sober. You're going to die, right? Because I knew exactly how AA was supposed to be done. What's really funny is that Bill Wilson takes the steps on page 13 of his story, and if you read it, you'll notice something. He does them wrong. He does! They're in the wrong order, it's emphasis in the wrong place. But our entire society is based on someone doing the steps wrong. So, if you're like me and you think you know exactly how it should be done, well, you know, Bill probably couldn't share it to your home group. Think about that for a minute, right? So it doesn't matter doing it right or wrong or indifferent. What matters is we're taking the action. You and I are looking for God. We're looking for the mystery in the spaces, in the gaps. We're looking for something that you can't see, touch, smell, or feel. And if you try to make that too mechanical, you will remove God from it and you will make it behavioral modification. And ain't nobody modifying no drunk's behavior. I tell you that. So what I'm looking for is mystery. Now, I've just said that, and some guy that I sponsor will hear this, and he'll go, but you made me do it exactly the way you wanted me to do it, and you told me if I didn't do it that way, I was going to die. Well, yeah, right? Because you came to me, and you asked me for my mojo, and that's all I got is my mojo. I'm not telling you my mojo is the only mojo, but it's my mojo. And if you come to me for help, we're going to do it my way.
or you're going to die. We're crazy, aren't we? Yeah? We are. We're out of our minds. God bless alcoholics. So I go through this process with my sponsor. And against my will, in the middle of the night, something sneaked into my heart and my soul and changed my perspective. And I'm a slow learner. It took me 3 or 4 years, but I was like 4 years sober. And I used to go to this Tuesday night meeting, the guy who was my sponsor at the time at his house, and I went every Tuesday for almost 20 years if I was in Vegas, and I'm on my way up to his house, I'm about 4 years sober, and all of a sudden I just start to cry. And I don't know, and I get to his house, and he opens the door, he goes, "You okay?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." "So what are you crying for?" I said, "I got to tell you, it's all true. It's all true. This God thing's real. This thing you've been talking to me about, this power that will allow me to feel connected and whole and useful and plugged in and part of and connected, it's real. It snuck up on me and it snuck in on me." Now, I don't want you, if you're new, I don't want you to think I was crazy for 4 years. I wasn't. Here's what happened to me at about 60 or 90 days sober. I'm starting to act as if. I'm starting to pretend God exists. I'm starting to do the dance that the piper is calling. I'm starting to be a guy that the question would always be, "Well, Sheldon, in this situation, work, women, family, whatever the situation is, money, what would a guy do that believed in God?" Not you, Sheldon. Not you. But a guy that, a good member of AA, would... What would he do, right? And I always know the answer to that. I know what I'm supposed to do. Well, do that. Act as if you believe in God. Not act as if the way I heard it when I was new. When I was new and you said act as if, what I thought you meant was pretend everything's okay. And when someone says, "How you doing?" try and get a space in between the noise in your head to utter out the word, "Fine," right? No. No, tell us what's going on. Find your 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 people that you can tell them the ugly, squirmy, desperate secrets. That you can tell them what you're thinking and what you're feeling. That you can be honest with them about the emotions and the upset and the angst. Find people you can share. But act as if God's got your back. My sponsor used to say that when, in the old days, when the army was in trouble and it would call for the cavalry, it had to act as if the cavalry was already on the way. And he would tell me to act as if, no matter how you feel, act as if you believe God's already got your back. And for years, it was pretend. For years, it was an act. And at some point, it stopped being an act. And at some point, I felt connected to God. This notion of step 6. I make this joke that nobody understands step 6 and 7. I was at a meeting the other day, and somebody said, "Well, you know, step 6 and 7 can't be that important. I mean, after all, Bill only wrote one paragraph on each of them, for God's sakes, in the big book, right?" I think that Bill wrote one paragraph on step 6 and 7 in the big book because the entire book is about step 6. My entire journey in Alcoholics Anonymous is about my attempt to try to become more willing to live closer to the Spirit. The first 5 steps get me prepared. They let me look at my past and look at my history and see the damage that I've done so I can see what it looks like when I don't try to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. The 8 and 9 are about clearing up the mess so I don't feel so guilty and so ashamed, so I will go to God, because I won't go to God with all that guilt. You'll be amazed before you're halfway through, because you won't feel like a bag of garbage anymore and you'll be willing to go to God. 10 and 11 are designed for me to keep the pipe open so I can continue to try to find a way to get closer to God. Step 6 for me didn't really come into my life until I started doing step 11. And then 11 drove me back into 6, drove me back into 6. And step 12 is the best gift of all. That's where I get to show somebody what I have found in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to tell you a quick story, because I think a lot of us have problems and issues with some of the primary relationships in our life, with our parents or our spouses. And I'm going to share with you a little quick amends, inventory first, and then amends story with my dad. And I'm going to go as fast as I can.
So I got to write this inventory, and of course the first name on the list is my dad. I hate my dad. My dad left when I was 2 years old. I got nothing to do with my dad. Don't want to talk to my dad. Don't want to see my dad. I'm not interested in my dad. So the first one is my dad. Why? Because he left. What was affected? Everything. Everything was affected. Couldn't see my way out of nothing. Second name on my list is my mom. My mom's the next name on my list. What did my mom do? She was short-tempered. She would yell and scream a lot. She made it difficult. She would remind me that I reminded her of my father. That was her favorite thing to say. And I knew she hated my father. And what did that affect? It affected everything. It affected everything. If you're new and you've never written an inventory, we could fill it out for you. We don't, because it's fun to watch you squirm, right? But the list kind of goes like this, you know, dad, mom, brother, current spouse or girlfriend or boyfriend, current boss, previous spouse, previous boss, uncles, aunts, neighbors, trickles down to anybody that's had any meaningless impact in your pathetic little life as far back as you can remember. I had the lunch lady from when I was in third grade. And it was real. I hated it. I show up at my sponsor's house with this inventory, and my sponsor had had me only write the first three columns. We do a six-column inventory. I know that's too many. Some of you are mad because you thought it was only four. Some of you are like, four? Hell no, it's five. Well, we do six. But anyway, so it doesn't matter. I know we do it wrong, but so did Bill. Doesn't matter. Right? Doesn't matter. Right? Just the mojo that I do with the guys that I sponsor. So I show up with the first three columns done, and he wants to do the rest of the inventory with me, and we start talking about my dad, and I won't hear any of it. I won't hear any of it. None of it. There's no way. You've got no spiritual mojo that's going to let me let that guy off the hook. He even tried his favorite one of all time, which is, well, you know, is it possible that your dad did the best for you that he could with the tools he had at his disposal? I said, I don't care. Get new tools. I was 2 years old. I don't care. I don't care. I'm not interested in it. So he bypasses my dad, and he doesn't want to talk about my dad anymore because you could see we'd hit a brick wall. And we go to talk about my mom. And I had tell you, I had never, ever thought about my mom as anything other than my mom. I do this. I give people titles, and then I give that title responsibilities, and then I judge them only on their life, on whether or not they're able to live up to the responsibilities that I've assigned the title that I gave them. Her name was Mom. That was her job. And I was mad at her because she was not the perfect mom. Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says this was our course. We realized the people offended were perhaps spiritually sick, though we didn't like their symptoms, and I didn't like her symptoms. They, like ourselves, were sick too. What was it like to be my mom? What would it have been like to be a young woman of about 22, 23 years old with two young children in a small Jewish community, abandoned by her husband, trying to raise those boys on her own? What would that have felt like? I had never considered it. It had never entered my mind. And I started to think about it. And I thought, oh, my God. What must that have been like? You know, my mom was an amazing woman. My mom did two things that, when I look back on it, were sacrifices that I couldn't imagine making. My mom grew up with affluent women, went to high school with affluent women. Her peers were affluent women. When my dad left and we became a welfare family to supplement our income, she went to the girls that she knew judged her, and she asked them if she could be a domestic in their homes. And she did that work under the table to supplement our income. The sacrifice and the humiliation of that must have been so difficult. And I'm mad because she's cranky. My mom made a decision, and I don't know if this was right or wrong. I have no judgment on this. It is the decision she made. She decided she was not going to bring another man into the home as a stepfather. She wasn't going to remarry until my brother and I had moved out. And so she went through a series of boyfriends but never had a serious relationship because she didn't think that would be good for the dynamic of the family. My mom sacrificed her dignity, her self-respect, her ability to have a good time, and I judged her because she was cranky. What would I have done in her place? None of those things. Where was I dishonest, self-seeking, self-centered, or afraid? My mom was a saint. Now, I've got to tell you, immediately my mom and I's relationship doesn't get fixed. There's work to be done in the amends section that we don't have time to talk about that did the big fixing in that relationship, but a crack in the wall was created. In that conversation, we talked about my mom's crankiness and the way she behaved, and she was short-tempered, and she had panic attacks, and she was difficult to live with. You know, what's funny is that what I think I have to do to forgive my mom is pretend she didn't behave that way. It's not what I have to do. I have to gain understanding of why she might have behaved that way, not pretend she didn't. She did behave that way. It was difficult for me growing up in that house. So then my sponsor says, let's go back and talk about your dad. Huh. Don't really want to do that, thank you very much. But let's go back and talk about my dad's story. He said, what do you think it might have been like for your dad to get married at a young age the way he did? In England, in the 1970s, there was still conscription. Men were sent off to join the military. Typically, you got married before you went off to join the Army. He joined the Air Force. He got married before he went to join the Air Force. It was a small Jewish community. They didn't know each other very well. They got married to each other. Maybe he came home from his time in the Air Force to find himself married to a woman that he didn't really get along with. Maybe he came home to find himself married to a woman that wasn't his soulmate and that he wasn't madly in love with. And maybe he saw a bleak future for himself. Maybe your dad saw a miserable life. Maybe he saw a difficult time. Maybe he couldn't imagine living his life without any joy because your mom can be difficult to live with. Maybe that's what he was faced with. When she came home and said, I'm pregnant, what would you have done? I'd have probably left. He stayed because I'm the second born. She came home with a second kid. And he just sees the bleakness and the unhappiness of his life. And he's in his early 20s. And he's going to live till he's 70, 80, or 90 years old. And he's got 50 or 60 years of unhappiness in front of him. What would you have done? Man, I stub my toe and I want everybody to feel it. I just do, man. If I hurt my foot, I want to go around with a hammer and say, do you see what it feels like now, right? I don't want to be uncomfortable. And he didn't want to. And maybe he left because he didn't know what else he could do. And maybe he left that he didn't stay in Leeds, and he left Leeds and he went to London, and London to Canada, and Canada to California, out of a combination of embarrassment, shame, and remorse. Maybe he thought it would be easier for her if he just was out of the picture and out of the way and she could raise the kids and he sent money. Maybe he just, right, wrong, or indifferent. See, it doesn't matter if I think he's right or wrong. I'm trying to gain understanding of why it might have happened. And I can understand what it would be like to be my dad. When I was 16 years old, I went down and joined the family business, signed on welfare, and got my own apartment and moved out of my mom's house at 16 years old, became an emancipated adult because I couldn't stand to live with it. I could understand why my dad did what he did. Where was I dishonest? The dishonesty in this is so terrible. You know, I got a really good life. I really do. And if you're new, I know you're happy for me. I got a really good life. I have my own business. My business is struggling, but I love my business. I'm passionate about my business. I have a son. He's 18 years old. He lives with me full time. He's an amazing kid. It's been an interesting year. In the last 18 months, I ended a marriage of 20 years to a woman that I still have a lot of care and respect for. We just shouldn't be married. And we ended that marriage. But I have a great home group, and I have good friends, and I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I sponsor a lot of guys. And I get to do things like come and hang out with you guys. One weekend a month or a little bit more than that, I get to come to a conference and hang out with passionate people about Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a really, really good life. Why? Why do I have a good life?
Well, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, right?
Well, yeah, because of AA. I tell you why my life looks like the way it does today. Because my dad left when I was 2 years old. See, if my dad would have stayed, we'd still be in Leeds in that frozen... It's cold, and I love the sun, and it's, you know, and I'd still be working markets. I'd still be a grafter in the markets. I wouldn't have the friends I have. I probably would have other friends, but not the friends I have today. I might have a son, a different son, but not my son who I adore. I might have a business, but not my business that I'm excited about. I wouldn't have my home group. I wouldn't have the things that I love. And the reason I have those things is because my dad left, went to London, went to Canada, went to Southern California, where I moved to be with him at 16 years old. And then him and I had another falling out, and I left and moved to Vegas. If my dad hadn't left, I wouldn't be in Las Vegas, where I have built an amazing life. My dishonesty about my... I would have told you my dad ruined my life. My dad, in fact, created my life. Without any meanness or animus to him at all, did he ruin my life or did he create it? Was it the worst thing he did or was it the best thing he did? Well, I don't know. But I tell you, I'm much happier when I have the perspective that it was the best thing he could have done. When I can take that perspective, I am free. Fast forward a few years and my dad moves to Las Vegas. And it's actually really cool. My son was 2 years old and he got to be this amazing grandfather. And I helped him get a condo and he bought a little condo. I gave him some money and he's living in this condo. And we're having this amazing life. And I've made amends to him at this point and we're connected back together. He meets a girl and he moves back to England. And I'm heartbroken. I feel like I'm being abandoned all over again. I feel like it's deja vu. I feel like not only is he abandoning me, but he's abandoning my son, another two-year-old. Here we go again, doing it all over again. On his way out the door, it turns out that condo I bought him, he'd gotten some liens on there, and he stuck me for $40,000. Now, you upset me and my son and my ex-wife, we're going to have problems. You take 40 grand from me, it's a whole different level of anger, right? I mean, we're talking about my money now, right? So I'm mad. He moves back to England, I'm angry, and I go to my sponsor, and I say to my sponsor, I hate that man. And I'm telling, now I'm sober a long time at this point. I hate that man, and you did this to me. It's your fault. You made me make amends to him. You made me bring the snake back in the house. You're the one that put me close to him again. This is your fault, and I think you owe me the 40 grand. I tell him I'm never going to speak to that man again, and he says this to me. He said, you know, you have that prerogative if you so choose. If you decide you never want to talk to your dad again, I understand. You're sober, you know, 10 years or so at the time. You've got experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. You have a God in your life. You're a grown man. If you want to make that decision, I understand. But I want you to make it with your eyes wide open. Your dad is old and frail, and in the next 5 or 10 years, he's going to die. And you can punish him for 5 or 10 years if you like. And you will make him suffer and it will hurt him. And you can make him suffer for 5 or 10 years and then he will die. You, however, will live for another 40 or 50 years. And for those 40 or 50 years, you will know that the blood in your veins is no good blood. You'll know your father was no good. You'll remember all of these things and you'll be haunted by the ghost. And when you hear the sounds, smell the smells, hear the music, go to the places that remind you of your dad, you'll choke on the poison that you have created. And you'll do that to yourself, and it'll be a choice that you will make. And after 40 years, you will die. Your son, however, will live for another 40 years. And for 80 years, you will not be able to help but give him the poison that you've chosen by choice to carry around. And you will put that into him, and you will give him pain in his heart and sadness in his brain for the next 80 years. And then he will die. And as long as you're willing to do that with your eyes wide open, I suggest you never talk to him again and don't try and fix this problem. And you carry on hating your dad if that's the choice you want to make. But I have one more question. Do you think you'll ever disappoint your son? Do you think you'll ever disappoint your son? Yes, I think I'll disappoint my son. The odds are. What lesson would you like to teach your son? Because he's watching and learning. Would you like to teach your son that when the fathers of the Fedi men disappoint them, you write them off and throw them on the garbage pile? Or would you like to teach them love, compassion, forgiveness, kindness? What lesson would you like to teach your son so he can learn that lesson for the moment in time that's coming that you let him down? Now I got to make amends to my dad because he stole 40 grand from me. There's a spiritual trip. But I get the call that he's sick and he's dying and I go to England and I make amends to him. And I tell you, I've realized something about my dad. My dad never meant to hurt anyone. My dad was wired in a way where people got hurt and he didn't do it on purpose. My dad was just a guy that had a blind spot that could not help doing the things he did. And I watched him cry afterwards many a time. He regretted it. It hurt him. He just couldn't stop. Have I ever done things to hurt people when I just couldn't stop? Can I find compassion for that? Here's the truth about my dad. My dad did the best he could with the tools he had at his disposal. And that was the amends I had to go make. I had to let him off the hook for that. And I'm really glad I wasn't new, because I couldn't find a way to say it to him where it didn't sound mean. Because here's what it sounds like when you say to someone, you know, I forgive you, you just didn't have the tools. Here's what it sounds like. Dad, I want you to know, it's not your fault. You just weren't man enough to be my father. It's not your fault. You didn't have the tools. You failed as a father. It's not your fault, but you are it's not your fault. But because AA has made me wonderful, I forgive you for your inability to do the right thing. So I couldn't. I get on the plane, I fly to England, and I'm sitting with my dad, and I've been in prayer meditation, and it occurs to me. And I tell my dad, I go, Pops, I want you to know something. I want you to know I'm glad you're my father. He says, what are you talking about? I've been a lousy dad. I said, that's not what I mean, Dad. When I was 16 years old and I moved to California, you taught me how to be a salesman. I spent 2 years with you in the trenches, and you gave me the career that I have today. Partially by physically teaching me, but partially because of your DNA. You're a great salesman. I am just like you. That blood is in my veins because it's your blood. And because I'm your son, I have been able to have a great standard of living for myself and my family. And I'm grateful you're my dad. People tell me I'm funny. You know, Mom, Dad, not that funny. It's your blood in my veins that gave me my personality. And I love who I have become. And I love who I am. And I am who I am because you're my father. And I want you to know, Dad, I am grateful you're my dad. And he started to cry. He lifted his head up and he said, I'm dying. I said, I know, Dad. He said, I don't know if I go to heaven or hell. I don't know if there's judgment. I don't know if the lights go off. I don't know. I don't know if there's reincarnation and I come back again. But if I get another shot at this life, I hope I can become the kind of man that you have grown into before my eyes in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought the amends was for him. Because in that moment, that I'm not much of an inner child guy, but at that moment, that little 2-year-old was healed. At that moment, I could breathe. You gave me that. You gave me the gift of forgiveness. What I used to think forgiveness was that I forgive you provided you stop it. And that's not forgiveness. It is not. Forgiveness is I forgive you even if you do it again. And I love you for your character defects and your frailties and your inabilities. Because I've done step 6 and I know you would do better if you could. And I love you and I forgive you. And I was able to love and forgive my dad, and I held his hand as he took his last breath. I was the man in the room that did that. And when I hear the music and I see the sights and I smell the smells and I think of my dad, I know who my dad was. My dad was a lovable schmuck. He was. And I think fondly of him, and I don't lie about the bad things he did. I shrug my shoulders and love him anyway. And I'm no fool. I know if my dad would have lived another 10 years, we'd have had more problems. We would have. Because Alcoholics Anonymous tells me in step 10 and 11 that there's going to be more things happen, but that we have a process, and it will always be my job to make the amends and repair the relationship. If you're an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, it's your responsibility. You're the one with the steps. Protect, defend, work on the good times in your relationships. Minimize, make amends, repair the down times in your relationships. Because you're the one with a program. It's our job. This is what a sober member of AA does. You go stand in the fire and you take it and you try to create connection. And I'm so glad I was taught that. I'm going to tell you one more thing, and I'm going to sit down, and this is important. Unfortunately, to this point, some of you like me and you're about to change your opinion. Well, that's okay. It's just the truth. It's just the truth. I was married for 20 years. Well, we were still married. We were separated, but still married on our 20th anniversary. We were together 22 years. The marriage was over after 10 years. The last 12 years, we shouldn't have been in the marriage. It doesn't excuse my behavior. I stepped out of my marriage. After I stepped out of my marriage, I knew that even though I could have stayed in the marriage, she wanted to stay married. I knew that staying married was the wrong thing to do. We tried counseling. We did all those things. The marriage was over. And I moved out. And I'm with my son. And he wants to know what happened. And I tell him. But people grow apart. And your mom and I grew apart. And I did the wrong thing. I should have respectfully ended the marriage. But instead of that, I stepped out and I cheated on your mom. And I'm sorry, bud. But I did that. Your mom did nothing wrong. Your mom did nothing wrong. I'm the one that made the mistake. And he said to me, Dad, you've been an amazing dad for 17 years. One mistake doesn't change that. A few months after that, I'm doing a workshop, a weekend retreat for some guys in New York, and I'm telling this story. And I broke down because it occurred to me, what lesson do you want to teach your son when you let him down? Do you want to teach him forgiveness or do you want to teach him judgment? Now, my son is an amazing kid all by himself. He has a big heart and a beautiful personality. And I don't know if I would have taught him it was okay for me to hate my dad. I don't know if he would have taken that lesson or if he would have forgiven me anyway. But I tell you, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years later, after that experience of making the conscious decision to teach my son love, tolerance, and forgiveness, my son gave me love, tolerance, and forgiveness. He's 18 years old and he lives with me full time and we are close. And I believe we are close not because of that one lesson, but because of the many lessons that Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me and has allowed me to grow into the kind of man flawed, likely to make mistakes, broken, desperately trying to get closer to God, looking for the mystery, looking for the magic, trying to be a service. I am so grateful to you and to people like you all throughout Alcoholics Anonymous who have given me the best life I've ever had, one far better than I deserve. Thank you for my life.